This is in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in the United States. We stand with you.
We're poor, Ashe. We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe. We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe. We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe. We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe. We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pits pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God," or "Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour our shame. We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X,
John Henry Clark, John Dr. G. Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
When you see them on the freeway hitching rides with their dogs and their guitars by their sides, you need to ask, what's all the lying and the dying and the beating and the cheating all about? Take time out. When you see him with the band around his head and an army surplus bunk that makes his bed, you need to ask, what's all the bleeding and the kneading, the lying and the spying all about? Take time out. Take a minute, feel some sorrow for the folks who thought tomorrow was a place that they could call up on the phone. Take a month and show some kindness for the folks who thought that blindness was an illness that affected eyes alone. When you see her walking barefoot in the rain, and you know she's tripping on a one-way train, you need to ask, what's all the selling and the yelling, the beating and the cheating all about? Take time out. Oh, you can sell your soul for money, then run off to the country for your cookouts and your parties on the lawns. While our children seek sedation in Eastern meditation or visions that go shooting up their arms. When you know that youth is dying on the run, and my daughter trades dope stories with your son, we better ask, what's all the bleeding and the kneading, the killing, and the thrilling all about? We better take time out and accept the fact that I am a people.
Just a nothing child. Why couldn't they just? is time to take another train. Don't care now what nobody say. I gotta take the pain away. It's getting worse day by day, and all my life has been this way. Can't reason with the pressure, man. Finances, all that we understand. You junkin' mama cries, you know. Would rip her, but I love her so. Love her so.
Are listening to Elders of Sankofa with hosts the Elders. The Elders of Sankofa radio broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, which operates on the timeforawakening.com radio platform. Reach out to them at Sankofa_think@out.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.timeforawakening.com, access the search portal, and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
Hello, family. Hello. Thank you for all joining. We have a wonderful show. This is your brother Kwasi, co-host with Mr. Charles Robinson. And our show today is going to be Fathers Parenting in the Village, Part 2. We had the first one a couple weeks ago with Brother Baba Anthony Courtney. Today, we're going to talk about the Black Fathers, how necessary for the parenting of our children. So join us as we continue to discuss ways the Black Father can learn to engage with his children. Children are a gift from God, and we will learn from our guests. Strategies that are essential for satisfying parenting. Our host, Brother Charles Robinson, myself, Sister Dee Dee Conley with the Ancestral Profile, and we also have Mr. Bill Davis and all on share some skills for parenting. We're also going to have Rosalind Griffin from the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office, and she's going to talk about some of the disparities and the issues that we're dealing with. But before we continue, we're going to go with our ancestral profile on Earl Little by Sister Dee Dee Conley. Sister Dee Dee, are you with us?
Yes, I am. And thank you so much. And good evening, family. I'm going to say a little something about Malcolm X's father, Brother Earl Little, because I feel like he was a great father. There was 10 children in the family. But anyway, Earl Little was born in Reynolds, Georgia, on the 29th of July, 1890, and he became a lay Baptist minister. I'm sorry, I had a little distraction there. He became a Baptist lay minister. Little was left with hatred for white people, as four of his brothers had been murdered and killed by white folks, and one of his brothers were hung. So he kind of like had a little, he just wasn't very fond of them. I don't blame him. But anyway, with one of his brothers was lynched. He later married Louise Little and settled in Omaha, Nebraska, where they became where they became involved in the UNIA, and that was the Marcus. That was with Marcus Garvey. Both Earl and Louise were supporters of Marcus Garvey's black nationalist ideology. And Louise was half said to marry Earl because she was very fair, because she was a very fair complected woman, and she sought out to marry a dark-skinned man. Her goal was producing dark children. Earl preached in the favor of going back to Africa and the Going Back to Africa movement, arguing that African Americans had no opportunity in the United States and that they should return home. The little family made enemies with the KKK due to their political activism, and they relocated to Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 1926, and then shortly there they moved to I want to say Lansing, Michigan, in 1929. The family's home was burned down, of course, by white folks. And in 1931, Brother Earl Little was murdered. He was killed. And it was said that he was run over by a streetcar. But what happened, they said he was hit in the head with a hammer or a hatchet and laid on the track. And the railroad track ran him over. And later on, they said that it was a suicide. But I chose Earl Little because he would take Malcolm with him, you know, to his Garvey meetings. And Earl was a teacher also. I mean, he had 10 children. So here was a father that was taken away from his wife, his 10 children. You know, and most of us that know about Malcolm, we know the rift that happened. But Earl, I just believe in my heart that he was a very good father also. And then I would just like to say this little piece. I was reading one of my favorite books by O.B. Tshaka, and it just kind of shocked me when I was reading where it said between 1976 and 1983, the number of black families headed by black women rose by 700,000, and the ranks of black men out of the labor force or unemployed increased by that same number. Where the black man is expected to support his family, he no longer has work or future prospects for work. He leaves the family. The impact or the removal of the black man from blue collar work can be seen in the statistics. Between 1900 and 1968, 75% of the black house 75% of black households had a husband and a wife in 1984. 51% of the households had a husband and a wife. Today, less than 37% of black families have a husband and a wife. The lack of the black father in the home has created a host of culture shifts in the black community, from one where black children are growing up without a father model. Black boys and young black men are lacking male supervision, and they're lacking that example from the black men, from the black adults, manhood. It's just sad. Thank you for allowing me to get that little piece out. I was reading that out of this book. It's called The Integrational Gap and the the Integrational Trap and the Generational Gap. This book, y'all, is something else. It should be in every black home. Thank you, Brother Kwazi.
All right. Thank you, Sister Dede. Thank you, Ancestral Profile. Before we go on with the program, we just want to give thanks to our sponsor, EDOC Advice. It is a website created to provide a place to go to get answers to your health or medical concerns. The questions are answered by health professionals and those who are knowledgeable about helping you make decisions about your personal health that make sense to you at www.edocadvice.com. I also want to give thanks to our Sankofa Council, Milwaukee. So I want to, if you have a message for Sankofa Council that needs more attention, send us an email message with your comment or question. And you do not want to call in, just send an email message to Sankofa Council, MKE, at gmail.com. That's Sankofa Council, Milwaukee. That's MKE at gmail.com. Thank you. Brother Charles, you and Brother Davis, you guys ready?
Oh, yeah. Bill Davis is here with us. And Rosalyn Griffin, are you there? Is Rosalyn with us yet? Okay, well, we got Bill.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, greetings. I'm glad you could be with us.
Hello.
Yeah, I met Brother Bill Davis a few weeks ago. I was introduced to him by Sister Shakira Abdul Ali out of Trenton, New Jersey, who was, I believe, in charge of health and social services. And I was sharing with her about my project of bringing into existence this healing circle for fathers who are struggling to be involved in their children's lives. So right away, she referred me to Bill Davis, who has a wealth of knowledge, resources, skills. His organization goes all the way back to 1859 when it was an orphanage. And now it's evolved to what it is right now. And so I'm just really anxious to get into a discussion, and he can share some of the things that they're doing in Trenton, New Jersey, in the state of New Jersey. And Sister Rosalyn Griffin works in the criminal justice system, and she sees on a day-to-day basis the impact of the criminal justice system on our Black men, which ultimately affects our Black families and ultimately affects the kind of parenting or lack of parenting that our children get. So why don't we start with Sister, ladies go first. We'll start with Sister Rosalyn. Why don't you tell us about yourself and what you're doing in that criminal justice system, and what are you experiencing in that system, and how do you see it impacting on the Black family?
Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for having me on. Just wanted to come on and introduce myself. I'm Rosalyn Griffin, currently working in the District Attorney's Office of Milwaukee County. I work as a victim witness advocate. So I have a couple different caseloads, some of the harshest caseloads that you probably see, which is homicides and general felonies. And ultimately, I work with mostly Black families. As I was telling Brother Charles earlier, about 90 to 95% of my cases deal with Black male defendants and or Black families in general who have been victimized. And so on a day-to-day basis, I'm seeing our man being locked up with no resources, no rehabilitation, just lock away and throw away the key. So, you know, when our Black men are put into these facilities, especially in these harsh times that we are living in, like I said, there are no resources. One, for them to better themselves while they are there. Two, for them to learn better parenting skills, which is the top thing that we are talking about tonight. And so as I told Brother Charles earlier, you know, when our Black men do get locked up, that takes away the main part of the Black family. And when that portion, that part, that male figure is taken away, that then puts everything on the Black woman. Okay, and a Black woman can raise her kids, but a Black male child still needs his father. And so we see the effects of the Black male being taken out of the household on a daily basis, whether it's, you know, kids having to get themselves ready for school in the morning. You know, maybe there's not enough food, so when they get to school, they're acting out because they didn't have what they needed at home right away to start the day. And we see that you know, when kids are acting out and they come into the criminal justice system, it's like a revolving door. So on a daily basis, that's just something that we're dealing with. And I literally see a head of a household, which is a father. I may see him 1 year, and then the next year I may see his son come through the system. And it just, it hurts because, like I said, there's no rehabilitation. So there's nothing helping our men, you know, to reacclimate into society, job skills. There's none of that. So it's just, it's a really big divide that I feel is never going to change. And as I told Brother Charles earlier, it's never going to change because the money resides in having Black men locked away. The system, when I refer to they, I mean the system, makes more money off of a Black body being either dead or in jail than they do being a functioning part of society. So that is mainly what I see on a day-to-day basis.
Wow.
So, yeah.
See, that's what you're talking about is the systemic and the structural aspect of our plight, the plight of the Black family. And in Wisconsin, and I believe we lead the nation in incarceration of the Black male. Isn't that true?
Absolutely.
We lead, and see, and then when you look at the unintended consequences of incarceration, it has a devastating impact. And that's another, and that's the reason why Wisconsin leads the nation in all of the disparities, whether it's healthcare, income gap, incarceration, education, you name it. We're at the bottom in the country, and that's because there's so many of our Black men out of the family. And like I said, that's the systemic and structural part. Now, there's another part that perhaps we can take control of. The systemic and structural part is going to have to be dealt with legislatively. But then there are some things that we can do, some self-help remedies that we can engage in. And so that brings us to Brother Bill Davis, and he's doing some wonderful things out there. Brother Bill Davis is skilled. He's so unique in his position because he's certified in anger management. He knows mindfulness as a strategy for healing, and he runs a program, the Father Center, which has all kinds of legacy and infrastructure. And tell us about that, Brother Bill, your position, the Father Center.
Okay, thank you, Brother Charles. Before I start, I just want to comment on what was just said, that the industrial prison complex is a monster, and the tentacles go far into the Black community, as well as into the rest of society. And so it's something that's going to, we're going to have to deal with, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that later, because that's part of our work at the Father Center. So at the Father Center, I've been there for 8 years, and my background was in computer science. I was a programmer, telecommunications. And when I retired, I wanted to do something to work with children. And so to make a long story short, I started investigating the Fatherhood Initiative, and I discovered the Father Center of New Jersey, which at the time was called UIH Family Partners, a name that goes back to 1859 when it was an orphanage. It morphed into a home for runaway girls, and then about 25 years ago, it became a part of the Fatherhood Initiative. And what I, in my research, studying about realizing that fathers were the cornerstone of the Black family, I realized in researching a lot of the fatherhood programs that they were strictly into the parenting aspect. In other words, obedience from the child, how to raise a child, things like that, the difference, discipline, punishment, those kind of things. And when I was interviewed at the Father Center, I realized that their work was much more encompassing. There was a lot more to fatherhood than just bringing up the child or the usual things we think of as parenting, those aspects of fatherhood. And I began to learn that there was a lot more, especially in the Black community, that was lacking. And so I started working there, and we have a program called 24/7 Dads. It's a nationally recognized program, and we do all those things to teach men, first of all, how to be a real man, what it means to be a man, and what it means to be a father, the importance of father. Charles and I talked about the father factor, all the benefits that come from having a father or a father figure in the home, and all of the negative things that come from the lack of a father or a father figure in a home. And so that's what we were focusing on. And of course, to be a good father, you have to be a good provider. So they were, when I got there, they were doing a lot of job development. And so I realized that there was a lot more to it than that. Our fathers face many, many barriers that they have to overcome before they can even get to the point of parenting a child. And so as time went on, our program just grew. It developed into more and more things. We can't do everything, but we try to address all the barriers that a man might come into. Okay, so for instance, as far as incarceration, men come out of prison. We have to have a plan to help them reunite with their families. So we do a family reunification workshop. And that workshop could be anywhere from 1 hour to weeks to help that man reenter the family. And it might not just be incarceration. It could be military, or maybe he was just out for whatever reason. We help them to reenter the family. So one of the things we found was as we became what you might call trauma-informed, we became trauma-informed, and we realized that trauma was at the root of many of the problems in the Black community. And so we set out to address the trauma in men's lives, and because that was the trauma and mental health issues were a big factor. So we started helping the men overcome their trauma by giving them trauma-informed care, okay, in addition at the same time to the job readiness and the job training, giving them skills. We do what we call short-term certifications. In other words, we don't have classes that it's going to take 2 years to get an associate's degree. All of our classes are anywhere from 1 day to 2 weeks, where the men can become certified and have a trade. Now, that does a lot more than just giving them a skill. It gives our men a sense of self-esteem to raise up. We realize that that's a big part of building a man up and helping them to become a father. So we also have a program called Dress to Impress, where every man that comes in gets a suit of clothes worth at least $400. Usually it's worth a lot more than that. It's suits that are donated by our affluent neighbors. And we give them a suit, two shirts, two ties, and a pair of shoes. And this not only gives them a costume or a dress when they go for employment or court or anything like that, but that also builds their self-esteem. So all these things together, we're trying to do to have a more holistic and comprehensive approach to helping a man become a better father.
This subject. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, because I can go on forever.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, this subject is very dear to my heart because I, my first child was my daughter, and she was born my second year in law school, and I wanted to be a responsible dad, and I had to struggle to do that, but ultimately I became a single dad, and she lived with me up until, you know, she grew up and became a woman and started her own family. But you know, I know that a lot of these guys do really care about their children, but the rap is they don't. They're deadbeats. They don't really care, out of sight, out of mind. And we had a discussion a few weeks ago about how I believe you had a chance to have a breakthrough with your child's mother.
Yes,
and you got counseling. You got counseling from an older person, an elder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, first of all, let me go back a little bit. I wound up separating from my daughter's mother when she was about 10 years old, and emotionally, it's really I was really distraught about that. Had no clue. I was young, no clue about co-parenting. The usual friction between me and her mother caused me not to be as involved or come over as much as I should. But I thought that I was being a good dad. And before I talk about what you just said, I just want to bring that up. I thought that I was a pretty good dad. After I started doing fatherhood work, I realized that I could have been a much better father, okay? My daughter was 39 years old, and when I invited her to my second wedding, my wife that I have now, my second wife, before she came, she said we had to have a talk. And she told me the struggle she went through when I wasn't there. And that even though I had been involved in her life, she had been traumatized by the split between me and her mother. And I was devastated by that because I thought I was a great father. And I realized that, you know, if I had known what I know now, how different my life would have been. What I did was that gave me impetus to try to help fathers, especially those younger fathers, to not make the mistakes that I made. So that gives me some direction with what I'm doing. But I was estranged from my first wife, and an old Jewish gentleman told me, because I was in trouble with the court, I had cursed out her lawyer, and I had a lawyer who was, I didn't know how to get a lawyer, so he was a weak lawyer, and they really kind of had me jacked up. And this old Jewish gentleman, he must have been about 85 years old, began to tell me some things. He told me that the only hole, that it was no longer me against my ex-wife, that it was me and my ex-wife against the system now. Because once you let the system become involved in your life, you're on a different grounds then. Their goal is to keep you separated, because that's how they get paid. Okay, so I had never thought of it like that. So he told me to take her some flowers and candy, which I did, but as I told Charles, I ate the candy on the way there, and when I got to the door, I threw the flowers at her feet. And she picked them up and said, I knew you cared about me anyway. So in the midst of all that friction and animosity, it was a breakthrough. And we were able to, thank God, co-parent the child in a better way. But like I say, I didn't do the job that I could have done because there was no fatherhood initiatives back then to teach a young man of 25, 27 how to parent and how to co-parent a child. So,
yeah, you know, we talked about so many of these issues in part one. And Queen Mother Jeanine James was saying, well, why don't we talk about solutions? You know, what's in the toolbox? And why don't we talk about some success stories? And that was one of them that you just mentioned. And we originally had scheduled Sister Alicia Price out of Minnesota, who was co-parented as a child, and now she's co-parenting her son. And she has, you know, she coaches co-parenting. She has a co-parenting consulting firm. And we wanted to have her with us today, but she was ill and she couldn't make it. And so we're glad to have Sister Rosalind Griffin to fill in. Now, Sister Griffin, we were talking earlier and you were saying you could see the difference between, like, you who were, you grew up in a family, you know, like a traditional family, if you will, and your husband grew up in a home where his father wasn't present most of the time or part of the time?
Correct. His father wasn't present. So I was just explaining to Brother Charles earlier that it definitely shows in the way that we parent our kids. I am more of a, I had both parents in the household, and my parents did everything they could. They were always there. My father had no issue with being present, and we never wanted for what we needed. I'm more of a parent who says, I want my kids to have everything that we didn't have. I want them to try everything we weren't able to try. And on the other hand, my husband is the parent that says, well, why do they need to do this? Why do they need to do that? Why, you know, why this, why that? And I just equate that with him not having those experiences or even being given the opportunity to, you know, have those experiences as a young child. You know, and I don't fault him for that. But at the same time, I need him to understand that as a father, you have to be present. You have to let your kids go through things that you maybe didn't experience it so that you can learn from it also. And so just in speaking with Brother Charles earlier, we discussed some things in our household that are solutions to the issues of the Black father not being present. And the biggest solution that we discussed, which is my number one, is therapy. Me and my husband go to counseling twice a month so that we have our communication skills on point. And so that also my husband learns different coping mechanisms as to parenting. One thing I didn't share with you earlier, Brother Charles, was that the reason I initially thought of counseling years ago and actually decided to go with a Black counselor over any other counselor in any other race was due to my husband's absent father. So I figured, you know, let me find a counselor who he can maybe relate to. So I sought out a counselor who was an older gentleman. He's been counseling, you know, Black families and, you know, other families for many years. He's a Black gentleman in his 60s. And I felt that my husband could relate to him. And so that is who we see, you know, on a twice a month basis. And so it's helped a lot. You know, it's helped open different avenues for me, but especially for my husband, so that he can kind of get a glimpse of how or what maybe a normal childhood per se should have been for him, so that he can give that to our kids. So.
Yeah, you know, it looks like we need to heal in many ways in order to participate. And a lot of the fathers who, for whatever reason, are not integrally involved in their children's lives, I would think some of the reason would be because of the relationship breakdown with the mother. And some of them may have some issues that they need to deal with. Like Brother Bill is, he knows a lot about anger management and mindfulness. Can you tell us how is that helping you work with the men you work with, your knowledge of anger management and mindfulness practices?
Okay. Well, and I would add to the angle, man, the mindfulness is specifically to address the trauma that they have suffered in their lives. Most of our men are survivors. We all are, you know, and you know the different kinds of trauma. There's even intergenerational trauma that's passed on from all the way back from our ancestors. You know, it's in our DNA that we've been traumatized. And so the mindfulness is a healing aspect to deal with the trauma. The anger management is a lot of the anger is related to the trauma that they have been through. And so the first thing that the mindfulness and the anger management is to make them aware of what's going on in their lives and in their spirits, there's a reason why things are the way they are with them. So we bring about that awareness first, and it's all geared toward having them, in spite of whatever trauma or whatever, to make them take responsibility. So the mindfulness is a small part of the healing aspect of trying to heal the men, because some of the men aren't ready to become fathers. They need to heal themselves. But as the young lady was just saying, I want to point out that you deal with two tracks of co-parenting. Okay. There's those parents who have a nuclear family where the father is living in the home. And then we have the non-custodial parent who is separated, living separately. And even though we are constantly reaching out to those nuclear dads who are in the home, the majority, I'd say 90% of the men that come to us are non-custodial families. And so we tend to focus our co-parenting on those men, because it's a whole different world when they're not living in the home. When there's a nuclear family, that's a great advantage. But when you're not in the family, it's very difficult. And so that's traumatizing. Our men are hurting when they come to us. They're hurting because, first of all, because of economic reasons, especially if they've been into the criminal justice system, for economic reasons, they can't take care of their responsibilities in a child in the manner that they would want to. And so that's debilitating to a man's spirit, to his ego. And a lot of men feel like they don't feel like a man. So they're traumatized in that aspect too, besides of all the other things they have to deal with in the world. And so we have to have, I don't call it treatment, but we have to have self care and trauma-informed care with everything we do to help strengthen those men and give them the resilience they need to become a good father, if that's making any sense to you there.
Yeah, that really is, because it seems like, you know, that's one thing that we can control. We can get the help that we need if we authentically look within ourselves and see that we actually do need the help. I'm so inspired by Sister Rosalind, who she and her husband have done that, and that's very laudable. At this time, go ahead.
Yeah, we try to encourage our men to go to counseling. You know, I tell them my experience with my second marriage. You know, I said, you know, when we first met, we went to counseling, you know, and we went to counseling before we premarital counseling. You know, we did a lot of counseling before and after, because it's very important to have that understanding with your partner, because we all carry a lot of baggage, you know, and we need, you know, it's a skill learning how to get along with someone, especially someone who you have a child with. So all of those things have to be worked out. And including teaching men, you know, the basic, the roots of parenting and how that, how they parent has a impact upon that child's life.
Got it. Listen, we're going to talk some more. We're just getting started. Brother Horace, did you have a message?
Yes, Brother Charles. I'm going to give you another advice from our sponsor, EDOC Advice. We provide special medical answers to seeking better understanding about medical conditions and health. We offer our faculties of EDOCs who are licensed physicians and health professionals who make themselves available to those globally seeking a better understanding of health issues and medical practices. If you have a service that you want others to know about, and you've written a book you need us to read, consider becoming a sponsor. Email the Black Reality Think Tank at sankofathink@outlook.com. Our contributions to support our broadcasting efforts can be made to Cash App, capital money sign, capital N, lowercase IRVANAINSTI, and PayPal, sankofathink@outlook.com. We're going to be going to a break shortly, but at the top of the hour, but right before we get to the break, I just want you guys to understand, if by chance we have some technical difficulties and you lose contact with us, just call right back, and we'll be on the line just waiting for you. So we need you to do. I thank you, Brother Charles and Mr. Davis and Sister Roslyn, for your comments. You know, the line will be opening up after the second half of the break, and the number for the Black Reality Think Tank is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832.
And Brother Horace, do we want to also give them the email address, just in case some people may not want to call in, may be shy or reluctant to call in, but they may want to send a note or a comment via email?
Okay. Yes, you can give that. You can contact us at Sankofa Council Milwaukee gmail.com. That's Sankofa Council MKE @gmail.com. So you can always email us with questions, concerns, and that call, and just do it that way. That is always an option for you. Again, I'll repeat that. Sankofa Council MKE @gmail.com.
All right. Thank you.
What you are calling African history and Negro history are the missing pages of world history. Then he said, "Son, go study the history of your masters. Go study the history of the people who enslaved you and find out why they found it a necessity to remove an entire people from the respectful commentary of the history of the world." But my earliest impressions of them was a people in power who intended to stay in power, and I began to wonder why they had so much and other people had so little, and why everybody I knew worked harder than they. Who made this arrangement? I studied European history and world history. Now, when I went back to Schomburg with some knowledge of background of European history, now he began to show me how to study African history. Arthur Schomburg taught me the interrelationship of African history to world history. Willison Huggins of the Old Harlem History Club taught me the political meaning of history. And from the lectures of William Leo Hansberry of Howard University, I learned the philosophical meaning of history. The most valuable lesson I've learned is that when you address a people by their right name, that name must relate to land, history, and culture. All people go back to the geography of their original origin and identify themselves, no matter where they live on the face of the earth. We have overused the word black, because black tells you how you look, but it don't tell you who you are. You can call an Italian white. That don't tell you anything about him. We are the only people who seem to have lost that all essential trait.
Time for an awakening media lineup. Monday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, with host Brother Jihad Ahmed, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambom and Sister Nataki Kambom, 9 p.m. till 10 p.m., Conversation Reparations, first and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Melanin Live with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening, with creator of Time for an Awakening and host, Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk, with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out, get informed, and get involved.
You are listening to Elders of Sankofa with host The Elders. The Elders of Sankofa radio broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, which operates on the timeforawakening.com radio platform. Reach out to them at Sankofa_think@out.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.timeforawakening.com, access the search portal, and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
Welcome back. Welcome back, all. We are now going to be open for some calls. We'll check with Dr. James, but before we say that, I just want to thank Brother Bill Davis and Mr. Charles Robinson and Robin Griffin for their information and on the things that we need to do to get things right with the parenting, you know, pottery and village. This is part two. We did this a couple weeks ago with Baba Anthony Courtney. So we will go to Dr. James. Do we have any calls or comments for anybody?
We see some calls from 414-339. Do you have a question or comment? Do you have a question or comment for us today?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, this is Karen Nelson calling in from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Just want to say great show. This is such a timely topic and such an important and powerful show, being that, of course, we, my husband Stanford and I were blessed to raise our children in a nuclear family, but there is still even trauma and drama even inside of nuclear families, too, that I believe that this healing is exactly what is right on point that we need as Black people in America. You ought to be commended for this show, and thank you for inviting us to be a part.
Thank you, Ms. Karen Nelson.
Absolutely.
And we have 414-339.
Press pound twice to unmute.
Yeah, that's another person similar. Okay.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello, Dr. Janine. This is Stanford Nelson, just calling in Thank you guys for the program. It's very informative and very well needed. You have our support. I'm glad that you put out where we can donate to the cause to be financially supportive, and we will be doing that on a timely basis and an ongoing basis. Keep up the good job. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mr. and Mrs. Nelson. I had the joy of participating as the village and delivering their son. And so I thank you for your coming on and sharing your thoughts and listening and continuing to listen with us. Thank you, Stanford and Karen Nelson. And going to 334-414.
Good evening. Thank you, Dr. James, for picking my call. And good evening, everyone. You know, in this process we call parenting, there are times when, particularly for us as Black men, that enough is enough and too much stinks. And sometimes the question that I'm really trying to allude to is it okay for us as Black men to be mad and be able to put our foot down, distancing between what we say and what we do? You know, I know that, you know, we talk about counseling and we talk about other issues, especially as it pertains to behavior, et cetera, et cetera. But there are times that we really need to lay down the law. So what do you all say with regards to Black men being angry, number one, and following up with maybe some simple butt whipping in order to get the point across? Do we just still go through this process of let's try to talk it out and have timeouts? So that doesn't work. Sometimes you really got to take that belt off and you got to start laying down some law. What do you all say to that?
Well, just for clarification, when you say laying down the law, who's going to be laying down the law to who? I just want for clarity.
Okay, yeah, the daddy is going to be laying down the law to the children.
Oh, I get it.
You know, there are some of us who have been given the law of the land on our behinds by our fathers at one time in our lives. And so apparently it's as though to me we're getting away from that. And so when we try to really get the point across and not back it up by action, it's as though, oh, he's mad, he'll get over it. Don't worry about him, child. And so you say, well, wait a minute. You're not taking what I'm saying seriously? And so sometimes for us as Black men, we need to be mad in order to get some changes to be done. Or maybe we shouldn't be mad as Black men.
Well, you know, we have to be angry. And well, the Bible says, be angry and sin not. But there's so much affecting the Black man. You know, you can't blame the Black man for being angry. And being angry is not going to solve our problems. But, you know, in my state, Black men are not present to lay down the law. If, in my state and here in Wisconsin, only 7% of children in the teenage category, only 7% now live with their biological parents.
Okay.
So where are the fathers to discipline any way they choose to discipline? They're just not present.
Brother Charles, could I speak
yes.
on that? Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
All right. So I always tell our men that if my mother was alive now, she'd be in San Quentin or somewhere, you know, because we were raised with the strap, okay? That doesn't mean that that's necessarily the ultimate way, okay? We teach our men that there's punishment and discipline, okay? We resort to punishment because punishment is easier. You know, you get the belt, you lay down the law, you give them a beating. Discipline works just as well, but it's much harder, and it takes a longer amount of time. And this is not a theory. This has been proven, okay? And so we teach our fathers, first of all, we find out what their parenting style. You know, you got the authoritarian or disciplinarian, which most of our fathers fall into that category. You got the permissive or indulgent, which a lot of our fathers who are separated from their kids become more permissive because of feelings of guilt, and they don't want to alienate that child because they're not in the home with them. And of course, you have the uninvolved parent, which is what we really want to stay for. But what we would aspire to is an authoritative, not an authoritarian. The authoritative demands a lot from his child, but he also demands a lot from himself and his self-discipline. And to spend the time to discipline and teach rather than resort to violence and punishment as a result to get a child to obey, because a lot of times when you do that, the child is acting not out of a sense of learning, but out of a sense of fear of the father. And so we don't tell anyone, we don't give instructions on whether they should use corporal punishment or not. That's up to them. But we tell them what the facts are and let them make the choice. So that's my personal opinion. You can achieve more without being violent with your child, you can lay down the law without beating, because when you beat, then you're traumatizing your child again.
Well, that's great insight. Thank you for sharing. Now,
thank you.
Sister Roslyn, coming from the criminal justice system, do you see evidence where there's been a negative effect of that kind of punishment or laying down the law?
Very much so. I don't per se work in children's court, but a lot of times the black men that grow from, you know, our young black men come into the criminal justice system, and, you know, they've been there for a long time. Primarily it starts when they're younger, because maybe, like you said, they didn't have the two-parent household growing up. And so the child is acting out, and now they're under supervision by the court. And so the trauma comes in, not only with the court, but with the surrounding, within the actual family unit. You know, the kid may be, you know, instead of a whooping, the parents could talk to them. But like you said earlier, it's easy to discipline, as far as a whooping, than to sit down and actually talk to your kids and explain why you did something and give them the outlet and the actual opportunity to explain why they felt the way they did at the time that they did what they did, as opposed to beating them. So absolutely, it to me is a negative effect on kids. And I won't, you know, block anyone, you know, from doing what they feel is necessary in their own home, because I was brought up as a product of, you know, you do wrong in your household, your parents whoop you. I was brought up that way. And so I don't per se knock anyone who does that. But at the same time, we have to understand that looking back now on what we had to experience as far as whoopings as kids, it was trauma. And so we don't want to subject our kids to that. So it is harder to do the work to sit down and actually talk to them. But in the long run, it's going to make them a better person, because you're actually, like I said, giving them the opportunity to explain their feelings. You're letting them be open with their feelings. And a lot of times what I see from, you know, the black men that come through our criminal justice system is they're closed off. You know, they're closed off because nobody listened to them. You know, nobody gave them a chance to explain. You know, it was just a one time and you're done, you know. So, like you said, they need trauma-informed care, but they have to know what that looks like. You know, and if they're never given the opportunity to have that trauma-informed care, they're going to revert back to what they knew when they were kids.
Thank you.
Hey, Brother
go ahead.
If I could just chime in a second, I was just going to point something out about my daughter. She was 3 years old at the time, and we were sitting in front of the house when I was living in Cuddy, and she would get up and run out in the streets. And I would get up and grab her, and I was like, no, Kimmy, don't do that. And like, after the second time she did that, I spanked her hand. She looked at me, and she just cried. Never had that problem again. Now, at 3 years old, that understanding level is not what it should be. But what she did understand, she understood the wrong and the pain of what I did, I felt, spanking her, because that was the first time, never happened again. But she didn't run out in the street again. And so I understand what Sister Rosalind means when she says, I'm not going to, because there's a difference from spanking a child and being excessive where you're using violence. And we, you know, we tell people not to act out of anger. But, you know, there's a form of where you can spank somebody, and then there's a form of abuse. And there's a difference. If I knock you down and I kick you while you're down, I mean, that's what we'd call abuse. But, you know, if I pat you on the hand, you know, I don't hit you hard, don't leave a mark or something like that, well, that's not abuse. But then someone could take it that way. And we've had people locked up for less than that. So, you know, it can be a difficult thing for some of these people in the parenting situation, because I have a nephew that was locked up. I had to take him to jail, and the teacher called on him. The kid was doing real well in school, and but he disciplined his son one day, and he spanked him on the hand, and he told the teacher that. And social services came. He doesn't have a record, no issues or anything, but what they put him through and traumatized the family. And he was, Johnny was out of the family and staying elsewhere for like 6 months. And it was a terrible situation. The school felt bad about it later, but once the system decides to do something, it just took several months for, actually it was long, it was almost a year before we could get him back. And, and I give my nephew just great praise for just him keeping it together. Because while his son wasn't with him, he was with the mother and staying in rooming houses in different places, and she was doing drugs and other stuff. And so it was a very difficult situation trying to keep it together.
Yeah, I had to call the police on two of my neighbors over the course of maybe 5 or 6 years. And I didn't like to do, I didn't like doing that, but there was this two-year-old who had wet on herself, and her mother was beating her like she was a grown woman. Wow. And I called the police, and they came there. I was standing at the screen door, and I heard the officer say, next time, do it behind closed doors. And that just really made me upset. But, you know, we have a lot to deal with in our families, in our communities. In the African community, and what I love about SANCOFA, the Council of Elders, is we're trying to bring into existence the principles that that sustained us, you know, for centuries. You know, like Ubuntu, I am because we are, and all the principles that if we had operating now, that we, I guess we call it restorative justice, which is a parallel to the criminal justice system, and I don't think we're doing quite enough of it. But, you know, if things keep going the way they're going, I remember earlier in the segment, Sister Rosalind said that it just seemed like it was hopeless because of the vicious cycle. Is that what you said, Sister Rosalind?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The cycle literally repeats itself. Because, I feel like our Black fathers come into the system, and it's not by choice, but there, like I said, there's no rehabilitation. There's nobody there to help them reintegrate into society, help them gain employment, help them with parenting, just normal everyday life skills, you know, it's like, okay, you go to prison for 10 years, you get out, now you're on your own, you know, and it's like they have all these stipulations under, you know, court supervision, but there's no resources to help them.
If things keep going the way they're going, what does the future hold? The predictable future, if things keep going the way they're going right now, we're in trouble. So it looks like we need to have a cultural change, a sea change. Earlier in the week, I was talking to Queen Mother Janine James, and she said something about men should have a, what's it called, when the child is being born?
A baby shower.
Baby shower. Yeah. I was at the park today over in Wauwatosa at Charles Hart Park. And in the pavilion, there were several women participating in a baby shower. And I walked up to a couple of them just to do a survey. And I asked them, what did they think about showers for men? And everybody agreed that men should have showers for their children. If these fathers were intricately involved in their children's lives, their behavior changes. I mean, studies show that when men are intricately involved in their children's lives, it's a win-win situation, win-win-win situation all the way around, because their behavior change. Do you find that to be true, Brother Bill?
Yes, I've got a couple of comments on that. Parenting, fathering, we tend to parent the way we were parented, because that's all we know. I've learned that fathering is a skill, not an art. We're not born knowing how to do it, okay? Because we learned it from our parents. My parents, they did the best they could. They did a great job, okay? But that doesn't mean that you can't improve on that. So parenting is a skill that needs to be learned. And a lot of the things that we're talking about, the negative things, is because our fathers don't have the correct skills in parenting. And so we need to teach fathers, and that's where the whole fatherhood initiative is about, is to teach them. And I used to get angry at some of the young men because of the things they did when I realized they had never been taught. Okay? And so you have to teach before you can judge or criticize. Okay? But when you say that things are getting worse, and I'm speaking specifically about incarceration, okay? When I first started doing this work, there was hardly any, and I can only speak about New Jersey and New York. There was hardly any help for returning citizens coming back into the community. Now there is an abundance of help. It's not as much as there should be, but it's actually getting better. Okay, the public is becoming more aware of the industrial prison complex. People are becoming aware that the destruction of the black family is not an accident. This system didn't just grow by itself. It had hands on that created this situation in the black family. Okay.
Right.
And family is important in all societies, but even in African societies, families, not individuals, are the cornerstone of the society. And still in Africa, most people still live in households that include not just the nuclear family, but the mother, the father, the children, the grandparents, the aunts. So it's a different situation. But this didn't come about by accident, okay? This system was created to disenfranchise and I would even say take away the black man's manhood. Go ahead.
So I have a specific question. What can suggestions can you offer to fathers who may recognize that things may have not been the best up to this point in relationship to the parenting, but as they become aware, what ways might they become again involved? How might they launch this with the mother in such a way that it goes more smoothly? You gave the example of the candies and the flowers, and I think that probably went a long way. But what are ways that one, women can also start a new page and say, I need some help with doing certain things, and how can fathers then ask the question, I may not have been involved before, but what is it that I can do to help in this process?
Yes, that's a complicated question, and it's one that we go out of our way to address. We start off with a workshop called She's a Trip, okay? Because I work for an all-male organization, so we only hearing the men's side. We are having discussions now because we realize to have true co-parenting, you need to have the mother involved, okay? And so just having the father is good, because he can do more than doing nothing, but the mother needs to be involved. And there's certain steps that he can take. So it's not something I could tell you in a few sentences. It's a class that we give on how to deal with that parent, okay? The bottom line is, no matter what the issues are and the relationship between the mother and the dad has the responsibility, as well as the mother. The mother usually has the job. But the father has a responsibility to overcome whatever obstacles there are to become a father and a father figure in that child's life. So that's what we tell them. We don't want to really hear your stories about her being a trip. She could be off the hook. What are we going to do? Let's sit down and talk and figure out a way for you to solve this problem. And each problem may be individual. You know, we don't know what's happening on the other side. We get a lot of fathers who the mother is so far estranged, or she may have a substance abuse problem or a million different things. The father has to sit down with us, and we try to give a strategy for him to work things out so that he can parent the child. And in some cases, it gets to the point where in order to parent that child, we have to go to what we call parallel parenting as opposed to co-parenting, where we have to have a method of parenting that child with the understanding that the mother and the father are not going to get along right now. They just can't do it. Maybe they're not mature enough. Maybe the blows that they have put on each other, the wounds are too deep at this time for them to actually sit down and work it out, but they still need to have a plan to parent that child. And so it's not something we can just say, hey, fathers, go do this. It's a job, and it's a very tough job. But as far as I'm concerned, it's the most rewarding when a father who had that kind of problem comes back and brings his kids to our office, and sometimes even comes back with the mother with the kids, and we sit down and have a conversation. So that's one of the struggles that we deal with every day, is trying to overcome that separating, because like I said, not only do you have the personal strife between the couple, but then you have the interference of the system, of social services, of child support, of all these other factors that are throwing darts into that relationship and separating that parent. So fathering is, in my opinion, it's the one of the most difficult teaching and overcoming these obstacles, one of the most difficult and challenging things I've ever had in my life.
Brother Horace, do you have some thoughts about how, in this example that I gave, how we could move forward?
I was thinking about what you were saying, and, you know, we said, I forgot the word we said, but I also remember I looked at it as it was a celebration, and it was a welcoming party. And I think one of the things that Brother Davis was talking about is, you know, giving a man a suit, a couple things to wear and so forth, you're trying to build their self-esteem. I mean, it's difficult if you don't love yourself, don't feel good about yourself, for you to, you know, show love and concern and kindness towards someone else, even if it's your own son. You have to have a place in your heart where you feel good. And when you feel good, it grows. And so I think when you had talked about a baby shower or welcoming party that fathers do, and that they traditionally do this, and where they show men celebrating with the birth of a son or a daughter, and the engagement with the mother would be a wonderful thing and a great start. And I think that's something that we could start to move with, you know, in regards to a lot of these parenting classes and different things and situations, because for the most part, these relationships, they're going to continue. Somebody's going to get pregnant. Knowing who the father is, those issues or those become difficult things sometimes based on how people look at relationships. You know, there's how you grow up, it makes a difference. You know, I for myself, I grew up, I had a co-parenting situation. You know, my mother and father split, got divorced, and then my father got sick. He had a form of Lou Gehrig's disease. And so my mother had me move in with my dad to help take care of him. And my father did what he could at that point to take care of us. And then he remarried. And then his wife later passed, and then he passed. She had got cancer, but it taught me, because later on, my wife had got sick, and she passed from cancer. And my kids were, my son was 10 years old when he passed. My father also had a son, Dion, and I had to raise him after my father and then Dottie had passed away. So that prepared me to do things. But, you know, just the love that I saw from just my relatives and so many other people that brought in the support. So when you talk about a village, you know, even though I might not have got it initially from my dad in the beginning, I learned more about it, you know, from so many other people. And they just touched me in so many ways, and I learned what to do and what not to do from those engagements I had with other family members and neighbors. I mean, it was truly a village of learning for me. So I really appreciate that, and I really appreciate what Brother Charles, Sister Rosalind, and Mr. Davis, what you're talking about as far as uplifting these men so that they feel good about some of the things that we do in regards to our relationships and showing love and concern, because some people look at that as a weakness. And then when we look, and then you touched about the systematically, some of the things that go on when we talk about, you know, just the systemic system in which our hands are tied. So it can be very difficult, like you said.
Well, thank you for sharing that. what you just described is what goes on in the village in the indigenous cultures in Africa, because it's not all about the biological parents, because right. it's the whole village participating. And also the mentoring process, according to Maladomo Somme in his book, The Healing Wisdom of Africa, he's distinguishing mentoring from how we do it here in America and how they do it in his indigenous culture. And because parents can't provide everything that the children need, they need to have right. mentors. And because mm-hmm. of mentors, they don't even have a concept of juvenile delinquency, because right. when the mentors are involved, they're like there to listen to the child more than anything else. But Brother Davis, can you share what you said about when you interact with these young men and you ask them about their children and you get the various reactions?
Yes. Our men are constantly are really aware of the negative images that's been placed upon them of being a deadbeat or something like that. And I found that men are caring, and everybody has a story. So when a man comes in to our organization, we don't start talking about jobs or anything like that. We go right to the children. And we ask them when the last time they saw their children. We don't ask it as direct as that, but basically that's what we do. We want to know what's happening with them and their kids. And we get either one or two responses. A lot of the men are offended. What do you mean? What about my kid? I saw my kid yesterday. I see him every day. I just talked to him 5 minutes ago. Why are you asking me that? And at the other end of the extreme, we get the men, they break down and cry because they haven't seen their kids, or they don't have something for the kid's birthday or whatever, or the mother is not letting them see the kid, which is a really big problem when it comes to co-parenting. It's called gatekeeping, where the mother, for whatever reason, maybe the father hasn't paid his child support, or maybe he hasn't been doing what she thinks he should be doing, so she denies him access to the child, okay? And so when our men come in, and I'm not talking about a small percentage, I'm talking about all of the men, they are concerned about their lack of being, their inability to be the father that they want to be. And so this, and I'm always touched by that. Sometimes the men, I keep a file cabinet filled with toys and stuffed animals for those men who have their who come in. They want to see their kid, but they feel bad because they don't have anything to give the kid, because they don't have a job, they don't have a place to stay, they just they're returning from prison. And so we give them some gifts. I give them two or three gifts to take to their kid, and just that being able to go to their kid with something changes the whole conversation.
Oh.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I did some co-parenting, and I remember I was helping a friend of mine. He was locked up for a while, and he wanted to take some presents to his son and to his daughter. And he was, they were court ordered to be apart, so he couldn't go over there. So I said I would take it over there. And when I went to take it over there, the mother didn't want to accept the present. She said, just let him know that I can take care of everything and we don't need anything from him. Now, his son, they share the same birthday, and their birthday happened to be on Father's Day, and that's when I was bringing it, what she said, and she said that in the presence of the kid. And I guess I was going to ask Sister Rosalyn if she could comment on this, because because he wanted to see the kids, she wouldn't let him see the kids, but that is not a legal act that the mother can do just because he might not be paying or have the money to take care of them financially. That still doesn't deny him the rights from seeing the kids. Could you comment on that?
No. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. It doesn't give the mother the right to deny him from seeing the kids. But if you look at the, I guess you dig deeper and look at the bigger picture, the mother holds some type of resentment or still cares for him. And, you know, he is not reciprocating that same energy to her. So then, you know, the kids become the pawn. And that is literally what tears, I feel, our Black men apart. You know, you deny him the right to see the kids. But oftentimes we as women, a lot of women forget that it didn't just take us to make that child. And if that father wants to be present, why take that away from him? We have to learn to put aside whatever grudges we hold, whatever animosity we have from any situation that we dealt with that other parent, for the betterment of the child. And that's where, you know, a lot, like I said, a lot of kids become the pawn, and they grow up thinking that, you know, dad didn't love me, you know, dad didn't want to see me, he didn't want to spend time with me, when it's really the total opposite. So I feel like we, you know, as a Black community, but as Black women mostly, we have to really step back and support our Black men, in just being there. You know, they may not understand everything, but they want to be there. They want to learn, you know, they want to be present. So we have to take that into account, and actually give them the space to, you know, make the mistakes that we as women make with our kids also, and not criticize them about that. Because at the end of the day, the child is the only one losing out, when they could really be gaining so much more from both parents if they work together.
Exactly.
Yeah, when I do talk to some women, I work with an organization called Parents Anonymous, and it's primarily mothers. And I've done a few workshops, and some of the comments I get is that, you know, he doesn't need a father or she doesn't need a father. I was raised in a single family home, and I turned out okay. You know, excuses for that gatekeeping. Gatekeeping is a serious, serious problem. And it's not legal, you know, because a man, because a man hasn't paid his child support or hasn't done something, it's illegal to deny him access to his child. Unfortunately, when gatekeeping happens, the man can't call the cops and say, "I want to see my car." He has to go petition the courts and so forth. So we teach men how to do that when necessarily. It's better to be able to do it person to person, but sometimes he has to go the way of the court to establish his rights to the child.
And if he does have to go that route, which, you know, I feel like a lot of our fathers in Milwaukee County specifically have to do, I would say one solution, you know, to the co-parenting issue is to really stress and teach our Black men to understand their rights as a Black man, first of all, but also too, as a parent. You know, if you understand your rights, you know, the bickering back and forth and you not being able to see your child, you know, if you have to result, you know, with the courts making an order, you know what to do. You know what paperwork to file. You know where to go. You know who to speak to. You know how to handle yourself when you have to get up and speak to a judge. And so I feel like that's one of the biggest issues that the Black community needs to address. It's just our people overall knowing their rights.
Yeah, if anybody out there in the listening audience needs more information about that, I do have a website, fatherhood-present.com site. That's my website, and I have almost 40 years of experience in family court as a mediator. And so if anybody is interested in learning more about their rights or how to navigate that process, and I think here again, we could bring many of those services into the Black community, and we could work through the church-based organizations and, you know, community-based organizations that have a peace mission. You know, we can train mediators to facilitate co-parenting and coach co-parenting, because in Wisconsin, you don't have to have a license to practice mediation. And through that mediation process, we can help, you know, these parents create a written parenting agreement, which they could actually file with the court. And I can, you know, with my skills, I can do a few things well. And that's one thing that I'm really committed to doing is to actually help facilitate co-parenting so that children have access to their parents. And so parents can have a joint vision for how they want their children to turn out. And they could put all this in writing. You know, they can come to agreement if they're willing to forgive each other and to listen to each other and look at what's most important.
Yes.
Do we have any call-ins? Do we have any people wanting to call in, Dr. James?
No, we don't have another list of people on the list. But my question, which I think still hasn't been addressed, and I'll have to be more specific. I am parenting what is now an adult child. And that adult child is having some challenges, and he has not had conversation with his dad for 10 years. Mm. And I felt that there were some issues going on with my child and that his dad needs to be aware of it and have an opportunity to interact, even though he has not initiated that. And I asked my child to contact his dad and to share what his concerns were and what's going on. And his dad was very happy to hear from him, but did not really serve to assume some role with his child. So I took that initiative, and perhaps there are some other things that I might do as I see that his father is not able to, for whatever reason, move forward in his role as father, which I feel does not end simply because someone is now 18. So my question is, what can you do? What would be your suggestion on how to get his father involved in the life of his son?
Well, if I could address that. First of all, you said the father, when he heard from the son, was glad to hear from him. So there seems to be no animosity between him and the son. Let me just tell you a little quick scenario that happened to me. It happened a few times, but in this one case, a gentleman had went to prison when his kid was 1 year old. His kid was 17 years old when he got out of prison, and he wanted to enter the child's life. And so I told him to write the kid a letter. He wrote the kid a letter, and the kid wrote him back and with four pages of all, every other word was a curse word. Mm-hmm. F you, where were you, I don't need you now. And the man was brokenhearted. I told him, I said, well, the kid wrote back, so that's a big step, because if he didn't really care at all, he wouldn't have wrote, he would have just threw your letter away. To make the story short, I told him to keep writing. After four letters, he kept trying. And now, the next time I saw him, he and the kid were together. They were going to a ball game. Mm. My advice would be to, if you made that one attempt, to not let that be the last. Okay. A lot of times we act and react out of expectations. So you are making this outreach to the father and expecting him to react in the way that you thought he should act. And it didn't work out. My advice, and things like that happen. Now, this is not a surefire way, but I would keep being persistent. I would call him. I would send him letters. I would send him pictures of the kid. I would remind him of his responsibility to the child and go from there. I wouldn't just give up after one attempt, because we, you know, you may not know what's going on inside that father, but I would not give up just with one attempt.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother David. We're going to have to make an announcement for our sponsors. At EDOC Advice, we provide specific medical answers of those seeking a better understanding about medical conditions and health. We offer our faculty of EDOCs, who are licensed physicians and health professionals who make themselves available to those globally seeking a better understanding of health issues and medical practice. And do you have a service you want others to know about and you have written a book and you need read? Consider becoming a sponsor. Email the Black Reality Think Tank at thankofathink@outlook.com. Contributions to support our broadcasting efforts can be made to Cash App, Money Sign, capital M, lowercase IRVANAINSTI, and PayPal, thankofathink@outlook.com. And more discussions can take place leading to the closing at 215-490-9832, an email address at sankofacouncilmke@gmail.com. Brother Charles.
Yeah, wow, man. We're coming to an end of this broadcast. It was a great conversation, and I want to thank Brother Bill Davis and Sister Rosalind Griffin for being with us this evening. And I want to thank all of the listening audience as well. And I thank also Sankofa Council for its support of this program and for sharing their vision for unity following Afrocentric principles and helping us to learn and use those principles in our lives. We look forward to bringing you more programs that we hope you will enjoy. Send us a message to, as Brother Horace said, Sankofa Council, MKE@gmail.com. And I guess it's time for us to say good night. Stay safe. Thank you. Bye.
rise and plant your seed in the early spring. Summer's gone away, winter's back again. Does every generation of a life reflect some movie scene? Change, nothing stays the same. A fool gets dumb, hides his heart, and plays the game.